You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. A few months ago, I met one of our guests at a dinner celebrating the NEJM Group's Journal Watch newsletter on emergency medicine, where that guest, Dr. Christy Koenig, had been an associate editor for over 15 years. Dr. Koenig told me that she had a new edition of her textbook on disaster medicine coming out, and I thought it might be interesting to talk about it with her and her co-editor, Dr. Carl Schultz. Both are professors of emergency medicine and public health at the University of California, Irvine, in the Center for Disaster Medical Sciences. Welcome to Clinical Conversations.
Thank you very much. It's our pleasure to be here.
Thanks for inviting me on the program.
I've read only parts of your 750-page behemoth, Dr. Schultz, and you wrote the introduction. Can you give us a kind of a Cook's tour of the volume?
Essentially, what we were trying to do is establish a textbook that's essentially the reference text for the specialty, that this would be sort of the definitive work that would really help define the current state of knowledge and also where the specialty might consider going in the future regarding new challenges and new opportunities. And that's, I think, what we were able to accomplish.
I see that at the end of every chapter, I think it's every chapter, there is a section, directions for new research.
That's correct.
So when the two of you were preparing the second edition after, 7 years? Dr. Koenig, who did you have in mind? Who would benefit from having this book at hand? Were you thinking about public health officials or first responders or both?
The book has a very wide audience. Everybody sees in the news all different kinds of disasters, whether it's an emerging infectious disease like Ebola or Zika or an earthquake or a hurricane or even terrorism. So the book will be useful for practitioners of emergency medicine, public health, for general medical practitioners who might be involved in managing or responding to disasters. And we really set our sights on an international audience and went out of our way to be sure that we had authors that gave global perspectives to help people understand that disasters do not respect borders.
Speaking of international, the international aspect of these things, there's a chapter, I think, on emergency management systems, and it's a kind of a rough guide to the various agencies worldwide. There's really a bewildering variety of interconnected agencies, and the chapter is a nice guide to that. How complex is that international system?
The international system is extremely complex because different countries have different resources, different cultures, different formulations for how they manage disasters. Some people might have the lead in one ministry or one agency in another country. Managing that same disaster might be within another country. And so we have to work on this connectivity. The other issue is that the nomenclature for disasters is not that well standardized. And that was one of the challenges for us, was to be able to express things without using language that was specific to one country or one culture. Even, for example, saying something like call 911, you will not find in our book, because in another country, the emergency access number would be different.
In addition, the issues with even coordinating these responses is difficult. There really still is not an overall international body that is effective at coordinating all the different response organizations that want to participate in an event. That's beginning to change, but we still had to cover a lot of different groups because there really isn't one overarching organization that controls international response. You'd think the World Health Organization or the UN might have some input, and they're trying to establish themselves in that respect, but they're still really, it's still to a certain extent a bit of a free-for-all.
And you will notice that the name of our center is the Center for Disaster Medical Sciences, the word science. And this is because we believe there is a unique body of knowledge for disaster. Historically, if you went to a book or a lecture, you would generally see somebody who was saying, I went to this disaster, for example, the earthquake in Haiti, and here's what I did, and here's some pictures of what I did. And what we want to do is look at what's the evidence to improve outcomes. We know disasters are increasing worldwide, and this is becoming more important. You mentioned at the beginning that each chapter has the final section on research issues for the future. The idea behind that is we wanted to use the expertise of the specialist writing each chapter to advise us what needs to be studied in the future. What is the research agenda that is important in order to save lives in the future?
That's not just something that would apply to academics, but if you're trying to figure out what we know and what we don't know, the research section, even as a clinician, tells you these are areas that we still really don't have answers to. And so that helps them frame their own confidence in the knowledge that's in the book that, well, I don't know what the answer is to this question is, but when you get to the research section, gee, nobody else does either. That's why they're looking into this. So it helps to frame both what we know and what we don't know.
As I was reading, some chapters really stood out. The one that I really liked was George Annis's chapter on ethics. And he said, and it was very simple, he said, you know, there are no special medical ethics for disaster relief, which I thought was interesting because, you know, I think what he's saying is, look, the ethics that we use in clinical practice should be enough. They don't change in a disaster.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, I wrote a piece with George that was published in one of our best journals, the Annals of Emergency Medicine, that was essentially looking at the ethics of disaster medicine and making that exact point that there isn't sort of a standard of care for disaster victims that's different than the standard of care for anybody else. And George was really effective in that chapter, sort of helping to make that point.
Well, he also talks about the role of human rights, human rights law, and he reminds us about, in addition to prohibiting torture, Universal Declaration of Human Rights prohibits cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatments. There's a lot to think about internationally, especially with the number of wars and other conflicts going on.
That's right. Okay. Ethics is a really important part of disaster medicine. I'm actually on my way to the European Master in Disaster Medicine course, where we have students from all over the world, and we'll be teaching an interactive session on ethics in disasters. And it's very unique because we have people with different cultures and different baselines in terms of their ways of thinking. So there's not necessarily a correct way or a correct answer, but we're teaching them basic ethical principles so that they can think through the principles ahead of time. Some of these principles conflict because some ethical principles will suggest that the individual has autonomy and certain rights, whereas other principles suggest that we need to optimize population outcomes, do no harm to populations. And so you could see if you had, for example, somebody who was refusing to get vaccinated against a deadly disease that might be contagious to another person, you would have an ethical principle saying to respect that person's rights. On the other hand, you would have an ethical principle to protect the population at large. So it can become very complex, and it's a very important piece of the study and the science of disaster medicine.
Is the organization, the Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, a good example of people who are in the middle of disaster, practicing disaster medicine?
They are a fairly reasonable group. They have an excellent track record. They have no political agenda, and they will become involved in situations, even to the extent of placing their own members at risk. But they have been relatively effective at intervening in large-scale disasters. I think the Ebola example is an excellent one, and their knowledge and expertise that they gained over the years, because they've been involved in that disease for many years prior to this most recent epidemic. And a lot of the knowledge initially that we used in the United States came from this group. So they really have a very important role and a sort of historically influential role within the field.
After the Boston Marathon bombings, I interviewed people involved with the clinical response, about four different people. They all made two points. They said They were very lucky that the bombings took place where they did, which is close to the medical tents, and when they did, which is at a shift change in the hospitals, which meant that the hospitals were, in essence, double-staffed. But mostly they credited the fact that they'd practiced often just for just such a disaster. How important is that, and how do you motivate people to go through these, you know, these practice things where nobody's really bleeding, and is that part of the art of disaster medicine?
Absolutely. Exercises and drills are critically important, and there have been many instances where people have practiced a scenario and that scenario happens and they credit that practice with their ability to manage it. One thing we know about disasters is they won't go according to plan. Something surprising will happen. But in these drills and exercises, what we learn is what's called emergency management. So we learn how to use an incident command system that's based on the functions of each person and has the ability to increase in size or shrink in size or increase certain resources depending on the event, so that you have the ability and the communications infrastructure and the resource infrastructure to manage anything. So those practice drills are absolutely essential.
You asked another good question, how do you motivate people to do it? And that is somewhat of a difficult goal to achieve because, as you correctly surmised, most of the time when it's a drill, people do not take it as seriously. Now, people who are involved in disaster medicine take it very seriously because they've learned from the hard way that without these kind of drills, you tend to make significant mistakes. But for the rest of the community, which you still need in part of a disaster, it's hard to motivate them. So when you get any kind of an event that occurs that is somewhat, might not be a real disaster, but for instance, I think the best example was the Ebola outbreak and how that affected our hospital, you get people for the first time often at these meetings, and they understand that these threats exist. And if you use events that occur, sort of experiments of nature, to take advantage of these to some extent to try and motivate people to get involved, you can sort of draft on these things and improve your overall response capability by using the events as a hook to get people to show up. And that has worked fairly well for our hospital. I was heavily involved in the preparing our hospital for a possible Ebola patient, and they will publish some work on that. And for the first time in 30 years that I've been doing this, we had people from hospital administration all the way up into the corporate offices participating. So it really made a difference. And using these kinds of events to attract people who normally don't participate is a good way to improve your overall disaster response.
There is a chapter on preparing for mass gatherings, and it's virtually a little handbook within your book on how to organize yourself. It's really very well done, and I'm imagining people who have, you know, rock concerts, even baseball games, large baseball games in their areas, wanting to have such a thing at hand when they're given the responsibility for running it. Who wrote that? Do you?
He's a really talented guy. His name is Michael Malloy. He's actually from Ireland, and he's an emerging expert in the field. He has a lot of both academic and clinical experience dealing with mass gatherings, and I concur with you. I thought his chapter was one of the better chapters within our book, in the sense that he really had both solid academic views, but also some very pragmatic approaches to how one could actually prepare to manage these numbers, and sort of a flexible, so you could scale up or scale down depending on the number of people you expect and what is the support in the community. So it's a really solid chapter, and we were very fortunate to get him. He's actually ended up being a co-editor for one of our competing volumes, another textbook in our field. That's how good he is. So we were very lucky to get him.
Mick is also a graduate of the European Master in Disaster Medicine second level master's program that I mentioned earlier in our conversation.
Yeah. Where is that held annually?
It's a year-long program that's mostly virtual learning. We limit the class size to about 35 people, but they're from all different countries and all different continents. The reason that it's called European is because that's where the degree is vetted, but the students come from all over the world. So they participate online with webinars, with online standardized modules, for the year, and then once per year for 2 weeks, there's an annual meeting in Italy where faculty from different countries come and go, and the students come to meet for a very intensive course, including a full-scale exercise where we are moving actual moulaged patients around and often working with other entities such as the military to really create a disaster using a lot of technology. For example, we used Google Glass the last few years and a lot of different types of skills to make it really feel real.
Would you give me your major takeaways for the book? What, you know, if there were a handful of principles that people came away with, even if they didn't read the book, what do you hope readers will learn from this?
There's a couple of things. It really has to do with the basic principle that this is no longer a field that people can pick up by experience. You can't just, I'll take a position as a disaster medicine coordinator, and I'll just sort of learn, I'll get some on-the-job training, and I'll just sort of figure it out as I go along. It's gotten way too complicated and way too sophisticated. You might as well try to become a physicist by just starting in a lab and seeing what happens. It just doesn't work that way anymore. And so you need some sort of codified body of knowledge that is continually evolving and expanding to really produce the next generation of experts, because that's what we need now. What the basic thrust of this whole book and the whole specialty is that we need now really well-trained experts in this field, and that these people have to become professionalized just like any other area of knowledge, physicists, biology, chemistry. All of these are unique bodies of knowledge that require training and expertise, and that's really what we're trying to communicate with our book and with our efforts.
I would strongly agree with that, and I would add for basic principles a couple of things. One is personal preparedness. People need to be sure that they and their families are prepared, because they won't be able to help anybody else in a disaster if they don't have their own family and their own systems in order. Also, that we're looking at an all-hazard approach, things that you might not typically think of as a disaster, a nursing strike, for example. If you don't have nurses, you can't take care of patients. So anything from terrorism to earthquakes to an emerging infectious disease, they have different characteristics, but we have to be prepared for all hazards and do what's called a hazard vulnerability analysis. So some people might be living in areas where they're at risk for an earthquake, some people where they're at risk for hurricane and not so much for an earthquake. So doing this hazard vulnerability analysis. And finally, concentrating on the four phases of comprehensive emergency management, which are mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery. People all too often focus on just the response phase because that's exciting. You get to jump up and respond to something, but we need to mitigate and prepare and often recover for a very, very long time. Once the media is gone, once people are less interested, there's still important work to be done to help people and save lives.
It's the medical care of social surprises, isn't it? I mean, one final question. Is there a chapter that you wish you'd commissioned that you didn't or couldn't get somebody to write? Is that an unfair question?
I don't think it's an unfair question. I think you have to ask somebody, if you guys are really the experts, you really think you got it all right the first time? And the answer is, of course, no, we didn't get it right the first time. We got it close. I think we probably got more new ideas in our book, the idea of the rehab chapter. Nobody's ever put a chapter like that in there. And if you look at the field, this is really an evolving new area of expertise. And so we're staying on top of this, but yeah, we're always reevaluating. And in our third edition, I think one of the things I would like to see is a one chapter on the pragmatic approach to actually deploying. So what do you need to, how do you prepare yourself to actually be a participant? To, if you sign up with either the Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontiers, or if you sign up with the International Medical Corps and you are deployed, what do you need to be bringing with you? What do you need to prepare yourself for? How do you respond? What are the challenges that you face when you get there? We're missing that piece of it. And actually, I have a file that I keep of new ideas for the next edition, and that's actually in there. So we're hoping to find someone who can help us with this from one of these prominent international organizations that can write that chapter. I think that overall we're 95% on top of this stuff, but yeah, we're always looking for new things, and there are always some things that we realize that, yeah, for the next edition, I think this would be a good idea.
And we did add 4 new chapters to this edition right along those lines, one of them on climate change, for example, one of them on community resilience. So we're always looking for new things because this is an evolving science. In terms of recruiting authors, we've had tremendous success. It's amazing that we've gotten true international experts. We're not using a student or somebody who's just looking through the literature. We're actually going to, for example, the person who wrote the chapter on volcanoes has deployed to volcanoes, is head of volcano societies, studies volcanoes, is a true international expert. And I think so that's the case in every single chapter. So we're very, very pleased and grateful for our contributors.
Well, I want to extend congratulations to you, Dr. Koenig and Dr. Schultz, and on your second edition. And by the way, it's what's the price tag? Is it about $220 or something?
It's about $200. It's currently listed at $205.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been our pleasure and honor.
Absolutely.
That was the 202nd clinical conversation. The others are hiding out at podcasts.jwatch.org, and they're all free. My executive producer is Kristen Kelly, and we come to you through the NEJM Group. Thanks for listening.